Hello. This month we have a very interesting interview with Dr. Tom Scragg.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Old Jodcast stalwart Tom Scragg, and you are now a doctor. You've now done your PhD.
Yeah, I finally graduated last year, the week before lockdown first started. So it's been a major change since then.
You got that in just in time. That's good going. That's good going. So what are you doing now then, as that's finished? What have you went on to?
I got a couple of temporary postdoctoral contracts up in UCLAN, the University of Central Lancashire, working on a couple of projects related to what I'd done during my thesis. So I'd been involved with DARA, which is the Development of Astronomy in Africa, which is a kind of technology transfer precursor to the build of the SKA. I'm still involved with that and some of the teaching side. And the development of a telescope down in Goonhilly, in Cornwall, to be added to E-Merlin, which was another strand related to what I was doing during the thesis.
Okay, then. Now, we're talking about strands coming from what you were doing in your thesis, so could you sort of give us a brief overview of what projects you were doing there?
Okay, I had two main projects for my thesis. Both were pulsar timing systems. So for those that don't know, a pulsar timing system is something that helps us detect the time of arrival of pulses from pulsars so that we can time the difference in intervals from one observation to the next to detect changes. And that gives us a lot of information about what's happening with the pulsar, what's happening with the interstellar media, what's happening in the close environment around the pulsar. So it's a very useful tool. But it does mean processing an awful lot of data because pulsars are very faint. So we have to have long recordings, and then we have to condense that down to what is a few milliseconds, tens of milliseconds, maybe a second wide at most, of a pulse. And we determine the time of arrival and compare that with our models that say, based on what it's done in the past, this is when it should be arrived. And any difference is great, as long as it's not an error in our measurements, because that gives us information on what's going on. So, pulsar timing system. The first one I was developing was a hybrid system. So this is a new model for pulsar timing systems. Rather than lots of individual computer servers working together, we were trying to use GPUs, graphics processor units, that you find in most of the gaming PCs and high-end laptops, to do the very repetitive high-volume processing that we get with pulsar timing, but sitting in a much cheaper workstation or enterprise-class server, so that it's effectively a very cheap system, £10,000 or thereabouts, whereas previous ones are either purpose-designed, which is expensive and difficult, and you can't change them very easily, or multi-node systems, which can cost hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Wow, that's a big improvement.
Yeah, as technology progresses, as computing progresses, what you can do gets faster and cheaper. And that's really where GPUs came in for us. Other people are using the same principle and developing their own systems, but this is specifically for Africa. Although we're expanding the use of it here at Jodrell Bank as well, we're going to put it on the back of the Lovell at some stage to enhance the system that's already there, which is now, I don't know, 15 years old. It gets more difficult to get spares when things are that old.
So I'd like to narrow this down a bit.
Okay.
You're talking about working in Africa with this project. Where specifically, is there any particular telescope that you're working with?
Yeah, it's in Ghana, just north of Accra. The telescope itself is a redundant Earth station, satellite Earth station, that used to be owned by Vodafone, one of the telecommunications providers there. When they get more fibre and cable connectivity, then the Earth stations became a bit redundant. You know, they're not great capacity, they're nicely available, but once you've got fibre along the coast, you put all your traffic on that. So these things were gifted to the government, along with half a dozen others in different countries across Africa. Back in 2009, somebody had the bright idea that these big 25 meter dishes could be converted to use as radio telescopes. So with a bunch of international agreements, it was decided, yes, we'll start converting them. They'll make a VLBI network, a very long baseline interferometer network, across most of southern and central Africa. Doesn't have an awful lot of engineering experience or astronomical radio telescope type experience. So this is a good building platform, training platform, for when the SKA arrives in force in South Africa. Plus you get lots of technology transfer. So I was working on the conversion of the first of them, which is the telescope at Kitunsi near Accra in Ghana. That's just 5 degrees north of the equator, so you get a good view of the sky north and south.
Oh, wonderful. So is that sort of then a particularly good place to observe pulsars, or is this just we have it so we might as well use it?
It is a good place because if you're looking at the galactic centre, there's far more radio telescopes in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere, although that balance is changing significantly with the SKA and its precursors coming online. So you get a better view. The more telescopes you've got for pulsar astronomy, the better, because you can settle on a target and monitor it for a long time, a long period. And that lets you establish the timing more accurately and lets you detect fainter and fainter pulsars. With timing, you have to go back to the target regularly to detect these changes that we were, I briefly mentioned earlier. So it's not, oh, we found it now, that's great, there's a pulsar over there. We need to go back and look at it again after a period. So if you look at the Crab, for example, we monitor the Crab from Jodrell Bank for 10, 12 hours a day, every day, because it's a young pulsar, it does lots of things, it's lots of changes, there's drifting clouds of gas and dust within the nebula. It's very exciting to monitor it and to see the changes. But you are taking virtually a whole telescope for half a day, every day. So now we've got 3,000 odd pulsars. We need to go back and regularly monitor each one to see what the changes are. Now, some are very stable, we don't see a lot of changes, or some are very faint and it would take an inordinate amount of time to go and observe. So if it's not doing anything interesting, it's there as a reference, but it's not something we'd look at daily. There are other pulsars that we look at much more regularly. One of the programs I've got with E-Merlin, for example, looks at a collection of 6 pulsars monthly.
Okay.
Because they do different things and they do interesting things that we need to track and take account of.
One thing that I do want to ask, though, is you're saying you're observing these and coming back, or observing 6 in a month. Is there any pattern to sort of when you observe a particular pulsar in that set to make sure you get sort of interesting things, or between when you can observe it and when you would rather observe something else?
Not a pattern as such. Strictly speaking, what you need to do is observe a pulsar frequently enough so that within the confines, the limits of the model you've got of its behaviour, you don't drift out more than a whole pulse. Because then you don't know if you've gone extremely early or it's the last pulse that's extremely late, based on your model. So you have to keep the phase coherence. That is, make sure you've accounted for every single pulse of that pulsar. So it kind of depends on how good your model is and how erratic the pulsar can be.
I was going to say, that sounds like quite a bit of a jigsaw to fit all the pulsars that you want in.
Yes. And there are, at Jodrell Bank, we monitor a whole set of pulsars quite frequently, but it does vary from the Crab, which is every day, for long periods, to some that we may go back to on a yearly basis to make sure they're still there or make sure that they're not drifting too much, that our models are still good. There are some, for example, pulsars in binary systems where they make close approaches to the host star, and we'll want to monitor during that whole period as best we can to see what effect. See if we can detect relativistic effects, for example, or gravitational effects, or interactions with the companion star's atmosphere if the pulsar comes close enough. Now, depending on the orbit, that could be, you know, that happens every month or every year. Or there's one where it's a 50-year cycle.
Oh, blimey.
And we had great excitement because it was happening recently, and we had the Lovell monitoring the telescope. I mean, other teams, not me personally. But so it does vary according to the pulsar and what science we're looking at and what we're trying to see. You'll also find there are some groups of pulsars that we monitor very regularly, looking for the effect of gravitational waves on the time of arrival of the pulses from the pulsar. What you'd normally see with a pulsar is random variations at a certain level. But if we look at 100 pulsars, say, on a regular basis, and we get a gravitational wave pass through our line of sight, in theory at least, we should be able to see that as a progressive effect on groups of pulsars as it moves across our lines of sight to the different pulsars. So we're looking at using that for the detection of gravitational waves.
Ah, okay. Although, interesting, you say it's moving across our lines of sight. Is that going to be something that's, like, does that make it easier or more difficult to sort of tune this in with things that are detecting gravitational waves here?
It's different frequency. We get into the area I'm not an expert in, but they're looking at different wavelengths. So the Earth-based detectors that are directly detecting gravitational waves coming across the Earth work on a particular wavelength, whereas when we're looking at clusters of pulsars, then it's a different wavelength. And obviously they don't necessarily have to come across the Earth itself at the same time.
Yeah.
Because as it moves through the sky, we can see it affects the signal path from each pulsar to us.
That's interesting and also slightly frustrating that you can't just have a nice, oh, we detected this and we also detected this in space as easily.
Well, it's the same as looking at electromagnetic radiation, everything from X-rays to radio, through light, through infrared, through ultraviolet. You're looking at different wavelengths and you're using different instruments to do it. Some are based on the surface of the Earth. Some have to be in space, above the water barrier in the atmosphere, the vapour barrier in the atmosphere, so that we can detect the signal at all.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. I'm hoping for something woefully optimistic, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're... I'm wondering, this sort of thing that I was hoping you'd sort of give me a little bit of detail about was you were saying about working with E. Merlin.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we go on to sort of what are you doing with E. Merlin? What was the part in the project?
Okay, it was a pulsar timing system. Once you've done one, the next one's not quite so difficult. Now, E. Merlin is a collection of 6 or 7 telescopes, depending on the configuration, scattered across the central belt of the UK. And its main job is to look at detail of continuous signals in space, so it examines structures down in fine detail. What we wanted to do was use it to look at pulsars and to help with timing pulsars. Now you've got 6 different dishes, they all have different performance. There's 2-3 different sizes of dish and they're in different radio environments, different radio frequency interference in their local areas. So we get 2 advantages from using E. Merlin. One, I've got 6 dishes rather than having to buy and operate a big telescope like the Lovell. We can use much smaller dishes that are already there. We can use the off time when it's not observing other things. And because they're in different radio environments, we can use that difference, you know, by combining signals together and then rejecting ones that are markedly different. Say, well, okay, that's probably RFI. So we'll reject that data for that period and then come back to the other telescopes and use the other telescopes. And then the next second, because interference can be very short duration, we can do the same again and look across the 6 telescopes and say, well, that one's now getting a lot of RFI, a lot of interference. So we can reduce the noise that we experience from the overall system by rejecting out-of-character RFI. It's obviously not from the celestial source that we're looking at. It's something local.
Yes, that's wonderful, because obviously if you've got one telescope, you just sort of throw your hands up like,
Yes, there's too much noise, therefore we need 10 times as long to observe the source to get a good signal. Yes. It's all about signal to noise ratio. And yes, the longer you take, obviously the more time you're taking on the telescope, the less you can do with other things.
But you've now got 6 or 7 shots at getting a really good signal with low noise.
Yes, by combining them together, we can make it look like a telescope that's much bigger than any individual dish. So we're not depending on single big dish telescopes. Yes. It's an existing system and it's already built and operational, so we can work with that. It's a lot simpler for us to manage. And because we can combine the data, we get a lot of improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio just from that principle. It's not quite as effective as the Lovell. It's about a third, from what I can remember from the from my thesis. It's in one of the chapters. The collecting area works out to be about a third as effective as a single big telescope like the Lovell. But then we don't have to buy and build another big telescope just to get the same thing going. And you can use this in principle on any collection of telescopes. It's not new, a lot of people have been doing it, but again, it's a specific retrofit to a national facility. We use GPUs in the processing of the data, but not in the collection. And again, it's a fairly low-cost system that gathers the data and then lets us process it.
Okay, and you're saying that lets us process it. Is this then something that you've been trying to make available for sort of like anyone interested in, or sort of any astronomers interested in pulsar observing can petition to use it?
Yes, email in, advertise it on their website. Although in practice, we're still tweaking a few things. If somebody came along and wanted to observe pulsars, they could do. It might have to be myself or Charlie or one of the other people at Dodrell Bank help them with the observation. Certainly running the telescopes, he's done by the normal team, the observers and the engineers and the schedulers. But running Lofty, which is the name we've given to the pulsar timing system, it's a bit handcrafted at the moment, but we're working on that so that it will literally be turn up, book time, collect your data, take it away and process it, or process it on site using the facilities at Jodrell.
It's slowly getting there. Some of the things you're working on at the moment then?
I've got a series of observations. So we, like others, I'm in a couple of teams that have bid for time on emailing to actually carry out observations. And we've got some time awarded actually on the telescope when we're in the middle of a run at the moment. So you get 6 months observing cycles. And I was lucky to get awarded 8 hours effectively per month over the current observing cycle. So we go back every month and we run a set of observations. We've done 3 so far and we've got another 3 left to do. Some of the FRB detections are a bit more ad hoc rather than scheduled. They're targets of opportunity. But again, we're using the same system to capture the data and process it slightly differently than for pulsar timing. You know, we try and make these things as multi-purpose as possible. FRBs, fast radio bursts. So it's another thing we use the pulsar timing systems, or can use the pulsar timing systems, to investigate.
Okay. I sense you're leading me on to a question here. How would one do that?
On Lofty, what we've got is a store and process system. So we capture the data in real time. We don't process it in real time. We look at it afterwards. What that means is we've got a host of data stored on the system at a very high time resolution. You know, data samples of nanoseconds width stored on the system, which means we can come back and do multiple analysis on it. We do combining, we get the pulse profiles out, we do the noise reduction for normal pulsar timing. So we can process it for fast radio bursts, which are very short duration, milliseconds, bursts of energy, but very bright. Most of them so far have been discovered to come from outside of the galaxy based on an analysis of the signal that says the dispersion measure, he puts it at an extragalactic distance. But we can do that with the same data. because it's now in digital format, it's not corrupted, it's not changed, it's not altered in any way, so we can do multiple analysis on it. We don't do that with the PTS on the Lovell. We have a different method for doing that. The first pulsar timing system I worked on, called Hebe, works in real time. So as the data comes in, it's analysed, folded, stacked, frequency dedispersed. We look at all of the characteristics to get a pulse out as we're observing the data. Whereas the Lofty, we store the data and process it afterwards.
Okay, so that gives you an advantage storing the data, but what was the advantage of, like, not what was the advantage of doing it straight away, getting the pulse out, like in the earlier system?
The advantage with processing the data in real time, it means you don't have to store it. So you still have to process it, even if you store it and then look at it afterwards. But with pulsar timing, we've got samples that are nanoseconds wide. We process it down to look for events of millisecond duration, and that's an awful lot of data.
Yes.
With Lofty, for example, we take the data down to 2 bits of resolution, but it's still microseconds long. And for an 8-hour observation, I'm talking about nearly 18 terabytes of data that we store. And we still have to go back and process that at some stage. So you need another machine, another computer system, that can process the data as fast as you can take it. Otherwise, you take a block of data, it fills your storage capacity up. You have to wait until you processed it and your storage capacity is free again. For straight pulsar timing, it's better if we can process in real time because we get the answers faster, you know, within hours or minutes of an observation. Where if you're doing an FLB search, for example, you can do it in real time, but that's a whole other computer system that, you know, I've not been working on. So there's swings and roundabouts.
Yes, and I guess then is that something that's becoming, the storage, is that something that's now starting to become easier or sort of less of a problem as we're getting better computing?
Over a decade, yes. So over 5 or 10 years, yes. But you know, I can fill the 100 terabytes I've been allocated by the 3 observations I've already done, virtually, with the analysis products and the rest. And I still need space to store the next set of observations. So I've still got to process it as fast as I can. And when you're talking about storage in hundreds of terabytes, it's not that cheap, and it can be quite difficult to arrange connectivity between your instrument and your storage system that's fast enough, because at the moment I store locally on Lofty the data from one observation, so that's the 18 terabytes. To transfer it to the offline storage then can take days, depending on the speed of the link and the amount of error checking that goes on between them.
I didn't even think of that as a problem, but yes. I mean, that's a lot of data to transfer.
Yeah. And the Lofty itself is configured in such a way, we've got 4 disk drives, but they're arranged as a stripe. So you write the first part of data to one. While that's writing, the next block of data is already to write, so we write it to the second disk in the stripe, and then the third, and then the fourth. And only that way can we get a write speed fast enough to disk to keep up with the data rate that's coming in from our telescopes. So we're talking a gigabyte per second of data across our system, across the Lofty system. It's a lot of data. And if you think a 3-hour movie on a Blu-ray even is only 3 gigabytes or 4 gigabytes, there's an awful lot of data there and it's arriving very quickly.
There's just sort of one more thing that I wanted to ask you about this. It's kind of on a tangent, but since we're talking about computing, The thing that you mentioned earlier that interested me was using GPUs. This seems to be a lot of what your project does.
Yeah.
I'd like to go into that in a bit more detail. So sort of what about GPUs made them what you were looking at using?
Okay. GPUs are a completely different design than the normal CPU. So in your laptop or your desktop computer, you'll get a CPU. It may have 4 or 5 or 8 or 12 cores within it. And the actual core itself is the bit that does the processing. to go back to my computer science days, which was part of my first degree, it's actually the arithmetic and logical unit. So you bring an instruction in, you bring a bit of data in. Depending on the program, it tells you what to do with that data. You modify it, you shift it left, you divide by two, wherever it is you're doing on that particular information. You then write it back out to main memory. And then the next instruction, you do the same thing. You bring the instruction in, you bring the data that's associated with it into the core, to the arithmetic and logical unit, do the action that the instruction tells you to do, write it out again. So it's a very multi-step process. It takes a lot of clock cycles to do all these fetches and divisions and multiplies and shifts and then store it again. Within a GPU, they're designed differently. For a start, the program is assumed to be relatively fixed. So you load it in once, and then what changes is the data that you bring in. So you do the same instruction or the same sequence of actions on different data, which means you've got a much reduced number of transfers from memory to the arithmetic unit, to the bit that actually does the changes and calculations within the computer. They're also built, because they're meant as image processors, and what you do with image processing for games and the like is just the fractional changes from what happened the last time.
Oh, of course, because it's images.
Yeah, so not all of the image changes, but the processors we use, the GPUs we use, have 1,046 separate cores or processing units within them. There's a very, very fast memory associated with all of these cores. So you do a bulk transfer of data into the local cache. You then process that cache using a fixed instruction. Whatever your program says to do at that point, it does it. Doesn't have to fetch a new instruction and do it again. It's already there, and then writes it out again to a very fast local cache. And then you do a bulk transfer to main memory. But you're looking at 1,046 cores doing this work for you. Yes. So it's massively parallel processing.
So I was trying to think sort of CPU, like that's an enormous number of cores if you're trying to do that on a CPU.
Yeah.
That is
most of the big parallel systems will approach that. But then these days, most of the big parallel computing systems use lots of parallel GPUs to do the same thing. So you break down your program into the simplest instructions that you can, that can be handled by a GPU. The other thing is, they have very simple instructions. On a CPU, you have what's called complex instruction sets, which means you can bring a number in, divide it by a number from another location, shift it left, and then output it again as a single instruction. Whereas originally, that's actually, you know, 4, 5, 6 different transfers and instructions actually going on. As a programmer or a computer user, you don't see all of that complexity. It's done in the background. With GPUs, it's very much more simple instructions and a very restricted instruction set. So you bring in everything in one go. And again, that's the other thing that makes them faster. We not only store the program on board all the time and don't change it, we have a very reduced instruction set to play with. So you have to make your programs as simple as possible. And that does help, especially with this kind of processing we do, which is vast amounts of data, but the same basic operation in each one. Add this to the last one, add this to the last one, add this to the last one, and so on and so on. Is, you know, a classic technique that we do. And that's just a single instruction and a memory transfer every time.
That's amazing. You made that work.
Other people wrote the software. I mean, CPUs, GPUs have been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's the basis of the way image processing works on gaming systems. So the principles are there. There's a lot of support tools and environments, software development environments available. We used a common suite of software that's used throughout the Pulsar community, if you like, to help process the data. They've been adapted to run on a GPU. So what we were concerned about was making sure we've got all the peripheral environment right so we could use that capability, which means a big, a fairly robust machine, a very fast bus rate on the motherboard, so we can plug the GPUs in, we can connect the serial interfaces, or the LAN interfaces in this case, to the instruments digitizing the data for us, and make sure we get transfer rates fast enough. Because although the GPU may count, may be able to cope with the processing demands, does the motherboard of the host system, is that fast enough to handle the data transfers? And now we've got two GPUs, because they're not quite fast enough to do all of the bandwidth and processing. So I've got two GPUs, I've got two data input ports providing me data, and I've got to get that data from there to the CPU and back out again and then write to disk. So the system has to be fast enough. The CPUs have to be big enough to handle this, as in its management of the interfaces rather than the processing task itself, and writing it out to disk so we've got the information available. Wow. So yeah, it was good fun.
It certainly sounds fascinating.
Yeah, well, it helped my background. My original degree was computer science and applied physics. Most of my career's been software or systems related. Although the latter half is radio and telecommunications. So yeah, it was a nice fit. It was something I thought, I could make a good go of that.
And that seems to be happening a lot more now in astronomy. I mean, there's an enormous amount of demand for people that you know, computers know. It's interesting to me that there's now a lot of people like that really involved in astronomy.
Yeah, I mean, it goes along with the whole automation of some of the tasks, some of these very repetitive tasks, and the fact that now with modern processing power, you can do things flexibly. So 2 years ago, it was a certain model, a certain algorithm for doing processing. This year, that's been tweaked, and it works a bit faster. So it's a simple change in software to implement that. Whereas, say, 20 years ago, when you were doing this in pulsar timing, that'd be a hardware change. 20 years ago, the only systems that were fast enough were purpose-designed hardware. So application-specific integrated circuits, where you'd have to design the actual application in electronics and get a couple of chips built, plug it into your instrument, and away it went. You know, it did the job at the time, just fast enough. But obviously that could take you a year to design and build an ASIC and test it and then make sure it's right. And you've only bought two of them, because somebody else is doing it slightly differently and wants the system their way. Yes, there's some commonality, but we're still only talking tens or maybe hundreds of devices to the same design. And if you think these days, production lines produce 1 million smartphones a day just from one manufacturer, then these are very low volume, highly specialised and therefore highly expensive designs. And next year you might want to do it slightly differently because it's a better way of doing it, and you can't. Because you have to go through that whole process again and spend the money.
But now you can work with these devices that are already there and already in sort of fairly large numbers for a lot of it.
Yeah, and things change. Things still do change. The original GPUs we put in the first system that went out to Ghana, for example, are now on the third iteration of the GPUs. That would go in, if we were to do another machine today, we'd skip a generation of GPUs and go to the next one. You know, design advances. It's still a fairly new and young area. So you get more bang for your buck.
It's been wonderful to talk to you. It's been great to have you. It's been great to have you back. That was Dr. Tom Scragg. Thank you for being with us.
You're most welcome. It's very, very nice to talk about it again.
Lovely. And now back to the studio.